So you and I are made for connection. We are made to know and to be known. We are made to have connection with God and to have connection with others, to experience presence, to be present with somebody. You know what that means, to be really present with someone, right? To be attentive, to be engaged. We are made to be present with God and present with others. I finally got around to reading a book, a really popular book from last year called Where the Crawdads Sing. And what a great little book. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. Just an amazing book. Delia Owens wrote it, and you know what's really amazing? It's the first novel she ever wrote. She's 70 years old, first novel. It is an amazing story of a very dysfunctional family. They live on the edge of the swamp, and the family is brutalized by a father who has post-traumatic stress disorder, coming home from the war. He's an alcoholic. And she describes this little girl growing up there. All of her siblings are much older, and she remembers the day that she sees her mother early in the morning, sort of escaping from the house, walking up the path, and she leaves. And then one by one, all of her siblings leave the house too, and then even some years later, her own father leaves, and she's just 10 years old. She's left all alone. Delia Owens said that she wrote the book in a way to describe her own story of not having presence with anybody. It's her own story of isolation growing up. Listen, it will warp you. It twists and warps us not to have someone present, someone attentive to us. Kurt Thompson is a physician. He wrote a book years ago about shame, the soul of shame. And in the book, he has a line, a memorable line that just took me aback. It leapt off the page and it hit me. He said this, he said, every newborn comes into the world looking for someone who's looking for them. Every newborn comes into the world, and imagine that. Imagine them, you know, wiping away the gook out of the newborn's eyes and their eyes opening up. Every newborn comes into the world looking for someone who's looking for them. But what if no one's looking for you? It would warp you, right? It would twist your soul badly. Nobody's looking for you. Nobody really cares. It will screw you up. And so we're going to talk this morning about this longing we have for presence. And we're going to talk about how we need to push back against this culture that would distract us from the presence that our hearts truly long for. And by the way, I've got some really good news this morning. Someone is looking for you. Take your sermon outline if you're into that. It's there in your bulletin. Let's dive in, shall we? Our longing for presence, to experience presence, is at the heart of who we are. God made us for experiencing presence with Him. It's innate. It's inside of us, this longing for presence. You know, I wonder how many of you have been to the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican in Rome. And there on the ceiling is Michelangelo's epic work, The Creation. So if you've been there, or even if you've seen a picture of it, you know it's the work where God is creating Adam. And Pastor John Ortberg, wrote these words about it, quote, "Look carefully at the painting and you will notice that the finger of God is extended toward the man with great vigor, twisting his body to move as it is close to the man as possible. His head is turned toward the man. His gaze is fixed on him. God's arm is stretched out. His index finger is extended straight forth with every muscle taut. It's as if, even in the midst of the splendor of all creation, God's entire being is wrapped up in his impatient desire to close the gap between himself and this man. He can't wait." Isn't that beautiful? God can't wait. You see, there is a God who pursues, the Bible tells us. He made us. He pursues us from Genesis to Revelation. The Bible is a story about presence. Eden was Eden because Adam and Eve had the presence of God there. God was our first, was with our first parents. They did life in his presence. We were made for his attention and for his delight. That was creation. So what's next? Fall. But we rebelled against God, and the intimacy and the connection that he gave to us, it was lost. And so what did we do about it? Our first parents, well, they hid. They ran from God. And so instead of running to God, they ran and they hid. And they hid by clothing themselves with fig leaves. Just the most pathetic attempt you can imagine to hide themselves. A pathetic attempt to get away from God because they were filled with shame. But you know the amazing news, though, is that God came to them. God came after them. They didn't run to God. No, God came running after them. Where are you, Adam? Where are you? He comes into the garden. Adam, where are you? God is searching, pursuing. And God continues this search in the wilderness, in the time of the judges, through the prophets, through the Psalms, in exile, through it all. He searches and searches and searches. Yes. Every newborn is looking for the face that is looking for them. It's God. It's God who searches. But ultimately, God's pursuit is manifest in who? Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us. Fall and now redemption. The Son of Man came into the world to seek and to save that which is lost. The pursuing God. Adam and Eve were covered with shame because of their rebellion. And you too, you and I, we too are covered with shame, hiding our shame. But the Son of God comes and he's lynched. He's hung from a tree. He's mutilated. He's stripped naked and publicly humiliated. He's what? He's shamed because he bears our shame in our place. He bears our sin in our place. Bearing shame and scoffing rude, in my place, condemned he stood. Hallelujah, what a Savior. And so what happens when Jesus breathes his last? The veil in the temple is split. The separation between God is removed. And that takes us then to what we read in Revelation 21. Creation, fall, redemption, now consummation. Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. That's where we're going. We belong to Jesus. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. Presence. It's the only thing that can heal us. Presence, you know, has healing power. You know, it's a powerful thing when you give someone your face, your presence, your attention, your love. It is deeply healing. You know, neuroscientists have discovered that telling your story to someone, you know, like this, the telling the story of your pain, maybe it's your failure, or maybe it's gross, harmful things that were done to you. Neuroscientists have discovered that telling your story to someone who is present and engaged and who has empathy and concern, it actually changes your brain. Now, I'm not the one saying that. I'm not a neuroscientist. I didn't come up with that. No, Adam Young has a podcast. He's a counselor. He's a psychologist. And I was listening to one podcast where he was explaining all of this. Telling your story, he says, can lead to top-down integration in your brain. It does. Top refers to the portion of your brain that's behind your forehead, your cortical brain. The bottom refers to the portion of your brain that's a little lower, a little deeper, your limbic brain. Now, how many of you knew that? A couple liars out there this morning. No. The limbic brain, it triggers your fight-flight response and your shutting down response. You know, like when you begin to reflect on a harmful or a painful part of your story, maybe a story that's filled with shame or fear or anger, or whatever, your limbic brain reacts and you enter into a state of fight, flight, or a state of shutting down. Like, I'm not going to tell this story to anybody, right? I'm not telling my, no one is ever going to know. I'm not going to go there. But he says, if you're able to stay with the story in the presence of another person, two things happen. First, this is fascinating, the other person's limbic brain regulates yours, which is to say their limbic brain soothes and calms yours. Second, though, and as a result of their attunement, their soothing, your cortical brain forms connection and linkages with their limbic brain. In other words, the presence of an attuned listener, it changes your brain. Isn't that amazing? You know what that's saying? If you are so present and attentive and caring and concerned for another person, and if they feel free to go places and to tell their story, to let you in on their story, and you love them and you're tender to them and you listen, you're not interrupting, you're deeply concerned and you have compassion, you actually bring them healing. You actually heal them physically. You have the power to bring healing to them. I'm telling you, love has power. Face-to-face connection. Connection has the power to make us well. And we were made for connection with God's presence. It's the only thing that can ultimately heal us. Yes, every newborn is searching for the face that is searching for them. Listen to me. Your search is over. Your search is over. This is the face of God that your heart longs for. Now, here's the second point. The second point is that there is something in our culture that is fracturing presence. It's fracturing our experience of the presence of God, of the presence of creation, the presence of other people, not allowing us to give our face and our attention to other people. Presence is something that we're going to have to fight for if we're really going to be present with God and with others in our day. And so what is pressing us to live lives of fractured presence in our day? Well, it's our phones, right? Our phones. Now, right away, you know, the moment I start meddling with other people's phones and their phone habits, you know, to preach about people's use of phones and the way that it's harming them and harming culture and presence with others. You feel like as a pastor, you know, you're yelling to somebody who's already gone off the edge of the waterfall. You know, they're already, you know, plummeting into the water, and you're yelling to them, hey, don't get too close to the edge, right? You know, you got to be careful. Those rocks are slippery, right? People are just gone. They're gone. They won't even listen. But you know, as a preacher, and we know this too, we know our own hearts, right? It's that way every week. Unless God opens our hearts, well, we can't do anything. And so may God do that, you know, even in the 10 minutes or so we have left. Listen, we don't mean to live lives of absence. But listen, without meaningful habits of resistance, smartphones are impossible not to look at. Our life is defined by what we pay attention to, and whatever cries for our attention, well, that is what we will heed. Listen to this. I didn't write this, but it's good. The phone is purposely designed to attract your attention and to send your attention to advertisers. Did you know that? Your phone isn't neutral. It's working for someone else. Did you even know that? Your phone is not neutral. It's clamoring for attention for someone else's commercial gain. It does not govern itself. Your phone will not govern itself, but it would love to govern you. It will produce in you a life of fractured presence. So think about this. in the 1890s, there are two men in Paris, and they're overheard talking. This is 1890. The first one says, "When the bell rings, you get up and you answer it?" "Well, yes, certainly," his friend replies. "Oh, I see. Just like a servant," concludes the first man. So the pair in question we're having this conversation are renowned artists Degas and Ferrain. And the one who's overheard this conversation and recorded it was Renoir. So under discussion is the technological miracle that had recently set the city abuzz, the telephone. But back to the initial question. So Degas asks his friend, "When the phone rings, you get up and you answer it?" "Well, certainly," his friend says. "Oh, I see. Like a servant." You guys know, you watch Downton Abbey, right? You know how this works, you know. The lord of the house pulls a cord, and underneath, down there in the servants' quarters, a bell rings, and when the bell rings, who gets up and runs? The servants run, right? And so Degas is saying, you actually put in your house a thing that will ring, and then you get up and you run like you're a servant. Well, Degas saw the problem, didn't he? That his friend had become the servant of the very thing that was designed to serve him. To avoid being mastered by your phone, you're going to have to cultivate habits of resistance. You're going to have to turn it off for hours at a time. You're going to have to keep it out of your bedroom. Or if you can't keep it out of your bedroom, at least keep it out of your bed. And you're going to have to keep it far away from the dinner table. You're going to have to turn off notifications. And so the question is, what is the aim of mastering your phone? Well, it's presence, right? Because the phone, I just said that, the phone is stealing presence. It's robbing you of your attention from things that really matter more. It's filling your life with that which is trivial and inconsequential. And so what is the aim of discipline? That's what we're talking about, right? Sacred practices of discipline. And the aim of mastering your phone is to have presence with those you love, like your family. The family, in fact, is the place where presence is learned, right? We learn how to love at home. We learn from infancy, and so after a mother has smiled at her child for days and weeks, her infant child, she finally receives the child's response. She's awakened love in her child with her attentiveness, and you know, it takes a little time, right, to do that. And then the child smiles, and the child can't stop smiling anytime anyone in the room smiles at them. Presence is fractured only by the interruption of the other's attention being diverted. Presence is fractured when your attention is diverted from your family and your loved ones to your phone. In fact, even the prospect of it hinders and it frustrates intimacy. And so spouses give up trying to compete. Right? No one's going to be vulnerable. In other words, you know, if you think of something that you might want to tell your spouse, maybe it's even a little vulnerable. And if they weren't to listen to it very closely, we would likely hurt you, right? But they don't even bother. You know why? Because you know that if their phone beeps or rings or whatever, you know that they'll look at it. You know that they'll look at it immediately. You know that. You know that they're trained and they will go to their phone over you. And so they won't even risk the rejection. You never even try. And you might say, "Oh, but Billy, I would never ever do that." Well, maybe. Maybe not. But you know, you have to understand that your spouse and your children, they can see the love affair that you have with your phone. They can. No one's going to be vulnerable. You know, studies have long shown that even the visibility of a phone in a room stifles conversation. It does. Husbands and wives, parents and kids need opportunities to connect with no possibility of interruption at all. Marriages need time alone where nobody can interrupt. And there should be no phones at the dinner table. One of the more formative places we have as a family is at the dinner table. The simple routine of dinner together is powerfully formative. And you've heard me talk about that before, but do not neglect the power of the table. So keep the phone away from the table. Car time, that's time for you to connect with your kids. So don't let your kids, you know, put their earbuds in and tune you out while they're listening to music. No, that's your chance to talk. That's your chance to have presence, you know. Any time with kids, particularly as they grow older, you know, your chance to talk with them, it drops off precipitously, and they won't easily give you their face. You know, there's a certain anonymity to looking at the back of your head, right? There's a certain anonymity of going into their room after dinner or late at night and laying in their on their bed in the dark, and they'll start to talk to their friends in a way that they won't. You know, sitting on the couch in the family room talking to you. Listen to me, young parents, these are precious moments. These are precious. You have to seize them. Young parents especially, because again, in our home, that's where we learn how to love. It's in our home that we experience presence. You want to know something really sad? Apple introduced the iPhone 12 years ago. 12 years. You know what that means? That means that any child in this country that is 12 years and younger has fought for their parents' attention their whole life with the parents' phone. That is so sad. That's why we need to push back. We got to turn it off. You have to intentionally put it away. You have to come up with good habits. You have to come up with a plan. And everybody's plan is going to look different. I get that. But you have to have significant periods of time where you're not connected. You could try the 1-2-3 plan. You know, 3 hours at night, you turn it off. You know, 3 hours during the day, turn it off. 2 weeks of every year, believe it or not. You know, 1 week at a time, and then 1 day every week. 1-2-3 plan. Maybe, but you got to build in regular times where you are not going to respond to it. And so you fight for presence of your loved ones, or even not just your loved ones, maybe your neighbors, right? Presence with others besides your own family, your neighbors, your friends. Presence is to choose a life of neighbor love and conversation and friendship and connection over a life of distraction and entertainment and busyness. And then last, presence also with God and with creation. We are distracted and not present, not listening, not taking in the wonder of our Creator's majesty. You know, phones and screens have undermined our ability even to enjoy the abundance of the ordinary. Okay, so maybe we'll put the phone down when we get to the Grand Canyon, but between here and there, no, we're on our phone. But we need constant distraction. We will not be bored. Because, you know, think about it, if we're bored, then we might have to think. And if we're bored, we might have to listen. And if we're bored, we might come face to face with ourself. You know, the abundance of the ordinary, we're missing it. Children used to be able to be transfixed by the ordinary world. They went out to play with no toys at all because they had something better than toys. It's called grass and dirt. And lizards and beetles and worms and turning over rocks to find slugs and wading through rivers finding crayfish and crawdads, just mesmerized by it all. The heavens declare the glory of God. So Psalm 19 says, daily it pours forth speech, but we're not even listening. You know, Annie Dillard once wrote, quote, God's creation should never play to an empty house. And so when the play of God's creative majesty is unveiled, and when the curtain rolls back on a new day and God's majesty is on display, what a crime. What a crime for nobody to be watching at all. We miss it. We miss so much of his presence. Our phone addiction is evidence that we cannot stand to be bored. We need constant distraction to escape that inner sense of worthlessness, our shame. You see, we're all the way back to where we started, aren't we? We're all the way back in the Garden of Eden. And they hid their shame with what? Remember? Fig leaves. And we hide ours with smartphones. You know, and if we do that too much, we won't hear the still small voice of God as he comes and looks for you. He says, where are you? Where are you? I want presence with you. I read an amazing little story, kind of a memoir of a young girl. When she was 14, she was so miserable that she took a bunch of pills and swallowed them. She tried to take her own life. Her parents were gone, and when they got home, it didn't work, and she was all sick and vomiting all over the place, and they just thought she had food poisoning or something, and she didn't tell them what she had done. They didn't figure it out. They just tended to her in all of her sickness. And the father was very, very concerned because she, you know, kept throwing up and throwing up and throwing up. And he said to her, you know, honey, can I get you something? I mean, is there anything? Is there anything that even remotely tastes good to you? And in all of her whimpering, she said, oh, I don't know. I think I'd like a plum. A plum. Well, it wasn't plum season. You know, there were no plums to be had. So she fell asleep for the night. And when she woke up in the morning, her father walked in with a bushel of plums. He had driven all the way from Texas to Arkansas to get them. And he drove all the way through the night and then all the way back through the night just to give her a plum. And these are her words, quote, it's when you sink your teeth into a plum that you make a promise. The skin is still warm from riding in the sun in Daddy's truck. And the nectar that runs down your chin is intoxicating. And it's then you snap out of it, or you are snapped out of it. Never again, she says, will I lay a hand against myself. Not so long as there are plums to eat and somebody, anybody, who gives enough of a damn to haul them to me. Everybody is born looking for somebody who's looking for them. So put away your phone. Put away your phone and go face to face with God. Let's pray. Well, Jesus, would you quell the shame inside of us? Would you quell that shame with the sound of your voice whispering to us and reminding us that we are your beloved? And we thank you for this holy table that reminds us that you didn't drive to Arkansas to get us a bushel of plums. No, you left glory and you came to earth to hang naked on a tree to cover our shame. So we don't need distractions. No, we need you. We want you. So give us discipline to put the phone in its place and to put you in your place in our lives. Well, this we pray with the very words that you gave to us, saying, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us of our debts as we forgive our debtors. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took a loaf of bread, and after giving thanks, he broke it, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after supper, he took a cup. He said, this cup is the sign of the new covenant, which is in my blood. Whenever you drink of this cup, you do so in remembrance of me. People of God, the table is set. The feast of grace is ready. Come now before the table.